I want to begin this morning with a modern-day parable. And I want you to see if you can get the drift of where this person's coming from that writes. So put on your thinking caps with me this morning. Before I read this parable, though, there are times in the preacher's life where he gets a little bit nervous. Particularly as he stands up to speak, you never know who might walk in. And depending on the kind of life you lived pre-conversion, you may be surprised from time to time. Fortunately, the people that just walked in the service I want to introduce you to shocked me to see them coming across the parking lot because I haven't seen them in a couple of years. And I don't even know how they found us. They live in Dallas. But this couple had a real influence on my life and my spiritual growth. And I want to have Kurt and Nikki Kirkpatrick stand up. And I just want you all to see them. And I want you to meet them after the service because Kurt's been a real blessing and Nikki as well in my life. And it's always great to have somebody walk in unexpectedly, just as long as they're the right people. Right, Kurt? Here we go. The emperor, so a parable runs, has sent a message to you. The humble subject, the insignificant shadow cowering in the remotest distance before the imperial sun. The emperor, from his deathbed, has sent a message to you alone. He has commanded the messenger to kneel down by the bed and has whispered the message to him. So much store did he lay on it that he ordered the messenger to whisper it back again into his ear. Then, by a nod of the head, he has confirmed that it is right. Yes, before all the assembled spectators of his death, all the obstructing walls have been broken down, and on that spacious and lofty mounting open staircase stand in the ring the great princes of the empire. Before all these, he has delivered his message. The messenger immediately sets out on his journey, a powerful and an infatigable man. Now pushing with his right arm, now with his left, he cleaves a way for himself through the throng. And if he encounters resistance, he points to his breast where a symbol of the sun glitters. The way is made easier for him than it would be for any other man. But the multitudes are so vast. Their numbers have no end. If he could reach the open fields, how fast he would fly, and soon doubtless you would hear the welcoming hammer of his fists on the door. But instead, how vainly does he wear out his strength? Still, he's only making his way through the chambers of the innermost palace. Never will he get to the end of them. And if he succeeded in that, nothing would be gained. He must next fight his way down the stair. And if he succeeded in that, nothing would be gained. The courts would still have to be crossed. And after that, the courts, the second outer palace. And once more, the stairs and the courts. And once more, another palace. And so on for thousands of years. And if at last he should burst through the outermost gate, but never, never can that happen. The imperial capital would lie before him, the center of the world crammed to bursting with its own sentiment. Nobody could fight his way through there, even with a message from a dead man. But you sit at your window when evening falls, and dream it to yourself. What's the point? The point is this. If there is a God out there, if perchance there may be, you'll never know. Because there is no possible way he could ever get a message through to you. There is no way through all of the masses of humanity, through all of the ages, through all of time, through all of distance, there is no way God could get a message to you. No way. So wake up, you idiot. Quit dreaming. What are you sitting by your window at night dreaming that God might be speaking to you? That Christianity may mean anything at all? You see, basically, what our society believes today, and this person is a well-known spokesman for our society who writes this parable, basically what our society believes today is that God, if He is there, has left this world in a state of confusion, and He's got nothing to say to you. There's no hope. It's almost as if God has pulled the proverbial plug on the bathtub of this world, and is just watching the dirty water swirl around and around and around down the drain and into the sewer. Do you ever feel hopeless in this world? Well, I sure do sometimes. I feel hopeless sometimes. When I look at this world and see that the oceans are covered with oil, see a government that's making a public spectacle out of putting to death 7 or 8 peasants after they themselves have rolled their tanks over thousands and thousands of people, when I recognize that even in our own backyard, a man out of frustration, lack of hope, destroys himself and his whole family. Hopeless. Has God just walked away from this world? Has He left us here all by ourselves? Do we have any reason to believe that God is even involved? The answer to that is yes. You see, God did send a messenger, and the messenger got through. He got through. He got through into this world. He accomplished the task that He set out to do. And He got through to me. And I trust He's gotten through to you. You see, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus answers the question, why did He come? Why did He come? That's one of the first things that He addresses almost immediately in the sermon. After He gets done talking about how to have a fulfilled life, He tells everybody, this is why I came. And that's what we're going to look at this morning. Turn in Matthew to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 17. We're going to look at the reason why Jesus came this morning. Matthew 5, 17. For those of you who may be visiting today, there's a blue outline in your bulletin that you can get a hold of, and it'll help you follow along, and you may even want to take some notes so you'll have a record of this message, and you can go back and look at it over again. Remember now, these are Jesus' words. The Sermon on the Mount was preached by Jesus. This is Him talking. This is not my idea of what the world ought to be like or what Jesus was all about. This is what Jesus says about Himself. In verse 17, look what He says. He says, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law, until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments, and so teaches others, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. The context of this message, now remember, Jesus is in the early phases of His ministry, and He's got a big crowd of people following Him around. And the obvious question that the Jews were asking is, well, how does this guy fit in? How does he fit in? Where does he fit into all of this that we've believed and been taught and this revelation that we have? In fact, in the first verse, in verse 17, where He says, I did not come to do away with the law and the prophets. Well, see, the law and the prophets were Jesus' hope. The law and the prophets were the Jews' hope. That was what they banked their whole world on, was the Old Testament. And Jesus was trying to explain to them how he fits in. And he says, basically, hey guys, I am your hope. I am the one. I'm not a hope deflator. I'm a hope fulfiller. I think it's interesting when we use the term Jesus, we get a mixed reaction from people. A lot of people, when you say Jesus Christ or when you talk about Christianity, what do they think? They think about intrusion, rules. When I say I want, Jesus says you don't. When I say I think I might, Jesus says you ought. Some people see Jesus as some kind of an outdated moral teacher, almost as sickening as tie-dye shirts and bell-bottom pants. All his rules and regulations are old and outdated. Why should we follow them today? And see Jesus as an intrusion into our lives, something that has to be endured. I challenge all the ones in high school and junior high. A lot of times, you feel like your mom and dad are beating you up with the Bible. They can't get you to do their rules, so they bring God into it and kind of put God on top of that. And all of a sudden you feel this under the pile. And Christianity and God, that's something I have to abide by. That's a hope deflator. Jesus says absolutely not. In fact, in verse 17 he says, do not think. The emphasis is on the beginning of the action. Jesus says, don't even begin for a moment to even begin to think that the reason why I came was to destroy your hope. Now remember, their hope is in the Old Testament. Jesus says, I didn't come to destroy your hope. I came to fulfill it. I came to make your hope full. I came to give you all that you've ever wanted. You know, the Jews had a real interesting history, and it's all recorded in the Old Testament. And the Old Testament basically contains two things. One is a history of failure. A history of failure. Remember way back in the very beginning, chapter 1 of Genesis, God creates a beautiful earth. Chapter 2 of Genesis, God creates a great man, puts together marriage. Chapter 3 of Genesis, man creates a terrible mess. Chapter 3 of Genesis, I mean, we're only three chapters into the book that talks about the history of the world, man falls into sin. And the curse comes into the world. Chapter 4 of Genesis, what happens? The first murder. The first murder. We're in the second generation of mankind now. We have Adam and Eve, and they have two boys, and those two boys do what? They fight, and one of them kills the other one. And from then on, it goes downhill more and more and more until God finally calls Abram, calls him to himself, gives him the Old Testament law, says, if you follow this law, you live by the standards that I want you to live by, and you need to seek me. And what does Israel do? And they build a temple to God, and they filled it up with all kinds of pagan shrines. For 1,000 years of history, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. What do we have? 1,000 years of failure. 1,000 years of it. God carries them off into captivity. They come back from captivity and they do the same thing. And you got the prophets like Malachi saying, guys, guys, are you never going to get the picture? It's a history of failure. But not only is it a history of failure, it's also a history of promise. Because every time Israel fails, God comes in with a promise. God comes in with a promise. And look what God promises. Look back at Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2. I'm going to look at a few of these promises. Isaiah chapter 2, beginning with verse 4. Excuse me, let's begin with verse 2 and read through verse 4. Now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains, and it will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his way, and that we may walk in his path. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now verse 4. And he will judge between the nations, and he will render decisions for many people, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. What's the promise? A new world. The Jews were looking for a new world. A world where there wasn't war. A world where there wasn't strife. A world where there wasn't fighting. Where justice and mercy would be the rule of the day. That was their hope. Look over at chapter 9. Read a couple verses in chapter 9. Verse 2. The promise is, these people who walk in darkness will see a great light. And those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Thou shalt multiply the nation. Thou shalt increase their gladness. They shall be glad in thy presence, as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou shalt break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, and the rod of their oppressors is the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and the cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. No more clothes to fight wars with. Verse 6, for unto us a child will be born, and a son will be given to us, and the government will rest upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace, and on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. A new ruler. A ruler that will come on the scene as God himself. Do away with war. Do away with politics. Do away with injustice. Do away with crime. Do away with everything. Set up a perfect order. A new ruler. Also, turn over to Jeremiah chapter 33. These passages are just beautiful because this is the future. And this is what the Jews were looking forward to. Excuse me, 31. Jeremiah 31. This is what God had promised. We've got a new world. We've got a new leader. Verse 33 of Jeremiah 31. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. What's the promise? A new heart. That is, taking the moral commandments of God off of the page and planting it in the heart, where it becomes second nature. Where doing God's will is what I do naturally, rather than rebellion and sin, what I do naturally. A new heart. And finally, in verse 34, And they shall not teach again each man his neighbor, and each man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more. A new start. A new start. Forgiveness. All the sins washed away. Do you have a new start today? Do you have confidence that all of the things that you've done wrong in the past are gone, and you're never going to stand before God and have Him point His finger in your face and say, you're going to pay for that. You're going to pay for that. That's the promise. Never, never will you have to face that. A new world, a new ruler, a new heart, and a new start. That's what they were looking for. And Jesus comes on the scene and he says, I'm not going to take that away. I'm not going to destroy that hope. You know what? I'm going to fulfill that hope. I'm going to be the one who makes it happen. Jesus is our hope. How can we be sure that he can pull it off? How can we be sure that he can pull it off? If that's what we're looking forward into the future, how can we have confidence that that's what he'll do? Well, look on in verse 18. He says, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until it's all accomplished. This is his promise. We see here two things. We see, first of all, the extent of the hope. He says, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law. The way Hebrew writes their symbols is a lot different than the way we write ours. And their smallest letter looks like an upside-down comma. You know how small a comma is in comparison to all of the other letters that we write? Well, that's their smallest letter. And he says, not one of those small letters will pass away until everything is accomplished. But not only does he say that, he also talks about the smallest stroke of a pen. Now, if you think a comma is small, you should see these little tiny strokes. There are two letters that look almost identical. And the only thing that you can tell the difference is they make this little curve right here. One of them has just a little bit of a hook on the end of it. What's he saying? He's saying every single bit of the Old Testament, down to the very smallest stroke of the pen, as the rabbi who's copying the scribe puts his little flair on there, every bit of that is going to be fulfilled. How can we have confidence that that's going to happen? Well, I wish I had time this morning, because many scholars have counted up to over 330 prophecies that are given in the Old Testament that were fulfilled at Jesus' first coming. Not one, not two, not three, 330 prophecies. Some of them prophesied between 700 and 1,000 years before Jesus ever walked on the earth. What's the probability of one thing that's prophesied, say, 10 years coming true? Maybe all right. Okay, if I were to predict today that Austin would have an economic upturn in 10 years, you say, well, you know, that's pretty general. What if I remove that by 1,000 years when there wasn't even a city of Austin? You say, that guy's pretty good. There wasn't even a city. The Indians lived here 1,000 years ago. There wasn't even any United States. You'd say, man, that's something. Now that's one. 330 prophecies, including where Jesus would be born, including where he would grow up, including what kind of death he would die, including many of the events that surrounded his life, his character, his appearance, his relatives, his followers. 330 prophecies. Now, if you can't believe that, you've got to have a lot of faith. Because you've got to believe that all those things happen by chance. Certainly a lot easier for me to believe that God designed it than that they just happened. Now that's only 330. There are a lot more prophecies in the Bible to be fulfilled. The prophecies about a new world, the prophecies about a new leader, the prophecies about a new heart, the prophecies about a new start. Those are all going to be fulfilled. And Jesus is going to make it happen. And he said, every single one of them is going to happen. But not only do we have the extent of the hope, but we also have the duration of the hope. He says, not only the little strokes are going to be here, but he says, until heaven and earth pass away. Heaven and earth have got to be gone in order for this not to come true. The world as we know it has got to disappear. As long as there's a world here, what Jesus Christ said is going to come true. If there wasn't a world, it wouldn't make any difference. To us, anyway. as long as there's an atmosphere, as long as there's dirt under our feet, as long as there's a sun, as long as there's a solar system, as long as the world is here, Jesus Christ is going to do what he said he's going to do. What do we do in the meantime? We got this great hope. We got this great person that's going to fulfill it for us and follow through. What do we do in the meantime? Well, we see in verse 19 that we secure our future status by applying that hope today. You say, well, that's in the future. That's in the by and by. So in the meantime, I'll do what I want to do, right? That's what Wendy's saying about tomorrow. You know, I'll do these things tomorrow. I'll live for God tomorrow. Now, that's not, there's some stakes here that you've got to take into consideration. And let's look at those in verse 19. He says in verse 19, "Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." You know this new world that's coming? You have an opportunity right now, today, to assure a proper status in that new world. You can either have low rank or you can have high rank. Now, I'm not sure how all that's going to work out. I'm not sure that, and I doubt very seriously that any of us are going to have badges. You know, I'm a high ranker or I'm a low ranker. I don't know what all that's going to look like. God hasn't chosen to reveal to us exactly what that status is going to look like and exactly what the difference is going to be. And we do know that there's positions of authority in the kingdom because the disciples talked to Jesus about that. And Jesus said, you know, those positions of authority on my right hand and my left hand, they're reserved for whoever the Father decides to put there. There are some positions of responsibility or authority that are going to be given in the kingdom to the faithful here on earth. But we know one thing from this passage, that there are going to be different ranks in the kingdom. And you know what I like about Jesus, among other things, is he doesn't force anybody to do anything. He says, your rank in the kingdom is totally, totally dependent on you. You've got a choice. You can either make a reliable choice, that is, to trust that what Jesus says is true and follow him in this life with a view that in the next life you're going to be rewarded for that, or you can choose to follow the relative choices of this world and take what they have to offer in the next life, which is this parable. Hopelessness. Let's look at the options. Jesus says in verse 19, "Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments," the word annul, basically means to break or to set loose or to set aside. In other words, you annul a commandment by not following it or by not living by it. Anytime God says, this is the way you're supposed to live and you choose to do different, you have a different attitude and you say, no, I'm not going to live that way. I choose to live differently. Then you've annulled or put aside one of God's commandments. He says, whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Anytime you decide to opt for the relative choices of the world and put away God's laws and God's rules and God's approaches to life, you've annulled the commandment. For example, somebody who says, God's commandments on sex, they're too strict. We live in a modern society. And in a modern society, we have different values. And our values are this. If I'm a teenager and I want to sleep with my girlfriend without being married, great, that's fine. I'm going to set aside what God says about that. No problem. That's a choice you make. How about the businessman who says, you know, when I'm gone for a week at a time, nobody will know, my wife doesn't know, I can do what I want to. And so I begin to fraternize with the gals at the other office. That's a choice you make. But when you make that choice, you set aside God's commandments. You put them aside. You say, I'm going to opt for the relative choices of this world and the relative values that the world has, and I'm going to choose that over God. And what does God say? Don't expect to be rewarded for that when you get to heaven. Don't expect a pat on the back. Because when you made that choice, you looked me in the face and you said, my way is better than your way. Now, I am not going to force you to follow me. That's not my way. You know, I think it's really something. God creates us and puts us here, and then he gives us free will. That's amazing. You know, if I were to create you all and put you all out there, I'd make you do what I wanted you to do. You know, I wouldn't give you that option. But God loves us so much that he gives us those options. And then it's our responsibility to follow through on them. Parents, I think one of the real keys in this passage, and this does not exclude young people, because you teach too, but in this passage it says, whoever annuls one of these, the least of these commandments, and so teaches others, you'll be called least in the kingdom of God. What does it take to teach? You think he's referring to getting up in front of the church and having a class? And getting up and teaching, oh, you know, you all do the wrong thing, you do the wrong thing. What's the most effective method of teaching? Modeling? Lifestyle? You know, every time you set aside one of God's commandments in your home, you're teaching your kids to do the same thing. You know, all you in high school, every time you set aside one of God's commandments, you're teaching all the other students to set them aside too. You know, because they look at you and they say, well, you all are Christians, and if you can do that, then I guess it's okay. They're not reading the Bible. They're not going to God directly. They're watching. They're watching. On the flip side, though, the reliable commandments of God will be rewarded. He says, latter part of verse 19, but whoever keeps and teaches them, they shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. That's going to be their title. That's going to be their position. And one of these days, we're going to be shocked, because the great men and the great women of this world are going to take a back seat in the kingdom of heaven to the humble, to the unassuming, and to the godly. And those people who stepped over you to get ahead by living by the standards of this world, who are being praised and rewarded right now by this society, are going to someday wake up in heaven, if they wake up there at all, but are going to wake up in heaven and be awful disappointed. And you know how long this life lasts? What's the life expectancy of an American now? It's about 75 years, I believe. It's about 7 years longer for you women than it is for men. So I guess God, he did a better job when he created you than he did when he created us. You were the second try. We were the first try. Years here, eternity in heaven. And you have the choice here to make those kind of decisions. Well, what do you have to do? Are there any strings attached here? There's a real important verse. Verse 20. It's one of the more important verses in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, it's so important that we're going to spend the next 3 Sundays dealing with the examples that Jesus gives of this verse. And if you look at verse 21, he says, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And on and on. Let's look at verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Verse 33, and again you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all. You've heard that it is said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but I say to you, or but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other. Verse 39. Verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That's wild. We're going to look at all those, try to figure out what God's saying in all those passages. Because boy, oh boy, I know there are times, particularly on 183, when I get angry at my brother. Does that mean I murdered him? That's my pitch, so y'all come back next week. Verse 20. Look what he says. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. You shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. So what? No big deal until you find out who the scribes and Pharisees were. These guys were the Mother Teresas. Of the Jewish faith. How many of you can claim to have done as many good works as Mother Teresa? Not me. It'd almost be like walking into this room and saying, unless you can live a better life than Billy Graham, there's no way you can get into heaven. At least that's what the Jews were hearing. Because the Pharisees were an interesting lot. You see, in the Old Testament, the Pharisees had gone through and counted up every command of God. Every one of them. You know how many there are? 613 by their count. 613 commands. And they said, okay, we can't break any of those laws. So, let's say these are the 613. Well, then they went, and they said, well, how are we going to prevent ourselves from breaking these laws? Well, what we need to do is we need to build a fence around the law. Okay? So they created a whole nother set of rules that went beyond the rules of the Old Testament in order to prevent themselves from even getting close to those laws. Let me give you an example. God says simply this, keep the Sabbath holy. Don't work on the Sabbath day. They came up with 39 categories of work to try to define what might fall in to the area of work so that they could make sure they didn't come close to that command. So they had 39 rules to relate to one of those 613. And these guys kept them. That was their approach. Boy, they were rigid on making sure that they did everything right. They had a problem, though. They were following the religious way. And I want you to look over at Matthew chapter 15. Jesus talks to these guys in Matthew chapter 15. These guys are on the religious road. That is, keep all the rules. Follow the religion. Look in 15:1 of Matthew. Then some Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem saying, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? Catch the distinction there? Now they're not talking about these 613. They're talking about this fence that goes around it, the tradition of the elders. By the way, if you ever want to read all those laws, I have them 8 volumes in my office. And if you ever want to just read and find out all the rules, they're there. You can come by and pick it up and read it. Okay, why do they transgress the traditions of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. And he answered and said to them, why do you yourselves transgress the commandment of God for the sake of your traditions? What a contrast. For God said, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of his father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever shall say to his father or mother, anything of mine that you might have been helped by has been given to God, he is not to honor his father or mother. And thus you invalidate the word of God for the sake of your tradition. You hypocrites. Now what's he saying? What's going on here? Well, what happens is, In an agrarian society, once you get too old to plow the field, you don't have any more income, right? You have to depend on your kids to supply and support you. Well, what the Pharisees used to do is they would have a practice where they would take a sum of money and they would dedicate it to the temple. And they say, when we die, this money will go to the temple. So therefore, it's God's money. And we can't give it to our parents to use for support because it actually belongs to God. Now, they would keep it in their bank account, drawing interest on it. And then when they died, the estate would go to God. And in that way, they could get around having to supply for the needs of their parents. And it was perfectly legal because God takes a priority over the parents, right? In their mind, it did. So they were trying to figure out a way to keep all of the rules without having any of the heart. That's the religious road. The grace path is totally different. The grace path is not focused whatsoever on keeping the rules. That's not the point. The grace path is the change from the inside out. It's what we talked about in being poor in spirit. Coming before God and saying, there is no way, no way that I can stand before God and keep enough rules to please Him. You know, I'm a sinner. And there's no way I can get into heaven. There's no way I can get into heaven. I can't get in there unless somebody helps me. And that's where Jesus Christ comes in. Because a few days from now, Jesus is going to walk a dusty road carrying a big old heavy splintered board on his back up a hill to be crucified for the purpose of paying for your sin and my sin. Now, we can either stand before God in our righteousness and say, okay, God, judge me. Weigh the good and the bad, and whichever is heaviest, boy, take me to heaven. And what God will do is He'll put His finger on the scale because God's standard is perfection. And there's no way you can get in following the religious road. But following the grace path is when you stand before God and you say, God, there's nothing in me that can please You. I need help. I need Jesus Christ. I need His blood. I need His payment. And trusting Him. And then He gets on the scales. And God takes all the bad you've done and weighs it against the precious blood of Jesus Christ. And the scales are always going to tip in His favor. So it depends. You'll get into the kingdom of God or not get in based on what you choose to do when you stand before God. Whether you choose to stand before God trusting Jesus Christ or trusting in yourself. And the choice is yours. The choice is to be made today. Have you asked Jesus Christ to come into your heart? Have you asked Him to take away your sin and give you forgiveness? Have you asked Him to be your hope today? You see, Jesus came into the world to bring hope, to fulfill all the promises, to give us a new world, to give us a new leader, to give us a new heart and a new start. That's what Jesus came for, and He wants to do that. Jesus wants to give eternal life to you today. Will you take it?